talk tonight is called The Peacefulness of Meditation. It should be very easy to meditate. All you have to do is watch the feeling in the stomach rise and fall, and after each fall, say the number one. When it has risen and fallen again, you then say the number two, and so on up to 10. When the number 10 has been completed, you start again with the rise and fall and saying the number one. And you go on and on, counting up to 10, as many times as you can manage, until the mind wanders. Then you start at the beginning once again. A very simple activity, you'd think. You don't have to climb a mountain to meditate. You don't have to wrestle with a lion to meditate. You don't have to fast to meditate. You don't have to have a university degree to meditate. All you have to do is watch your feeling in the body. That's very simple, you say. I can do that. But you quickly discover that you can't do it. What's more, this simple act you can't even do for 5 continuous minutes. Why? Because the practice of watching the rise and fall hasn't been repeated often enough. That is one of the reasons. But the real reason, the main reason you can't concentrate on the rise and fall for any length of time, is because your attitude to sensory data is faulty. Your attitude to feelings, to thoughts, to mental states, which you regard as interrupting the watching of the rise and fall, these too are also faulty. For example, if after watching the rise and fall for some time, up pops the thought, "Is this all there is to meditation?" and you take that thought seriously, that is the arising of impatience. You take that thought seriously only because you have lurking in the back of the mind a wrong view about meditation. You think that all you have to do is concentrate on the rise and fall of the abdomen for a few times and then something will happen. There's not the realization that observation of the rise and fall has to be repeated thousands of times before anything happens. Once you have the latter view, then immediately there is patience. You have changed your attitude about what is required to bring about successful concentration on the rise and fall, so impatience, in this precise form, doesn't arise again. The thought, "Is this all there is to meditation?" may well pop into mind again, but you'll know it's conditioned reflex, so won't take the thought seriously. Thus the mind doesn't go jagged and spiky, but remains smooth, and it's easy then to return to the rise and fall. Before it is possible for you to direct your attention to the rise and fall and keep it there for any length of time, with it feeling light, bright, comfortable, and at peace, a lot of work has to be done on your attitude to what happens in your mind. All of this looking to see where one's attitude is wrong is also meditation. Keeping the attention pinned to rise and fall is only a very small part of the meditative training. When you realize this, you start to look to see what pulls you off and keeps you off the rise and fall. With time, you notice a pattern forming, and you see that what pulls you off is taking seriously thoughts about the odd mental picture, the odd sound, or perception, or the odd feeling that interrupts the rise and fall. if when you start to meditate, you are plagued by, let's say, depression, and you take a close look to see what your response to that depression is when you are in the middle of a bout of depression. And you will notice that you hold a strong belief that the depression is going to go on forever. That belief is what is known as the wrong view of seeing a thing as permanent when in actual fact it is impermanent. When you are depressed, there is no way the mind is tranquil enough or joyful enough to settle contentedly and repeatedly on the rise and fall. So your first task is to make inroads into that depression, to break it up so it's not lasting for hours and hours. And the way you do that is by paying particular attention to the mark of change. A meditator once commented on how he had never understood what I meant when I said that a person had to be introduced to the concept of change before they noticed just how much things actually do change. He felt that as long as one was just aware, then surely change would become obvious. The reason why just being aware is not sufficient and doesn't bring immediate insight is that when aware but not comprehending what it is one's supposed to be looking for, all that one notices in the external environment and within oneself are things that support one's existing views. For example, you might know someone who frequently says, "Isn't it a terrible world we live in today? So much war, so much violence, robbery, and sexual abuse. It never used to be like that in my youth." Year after year, they make the same statement. All they are ever aware of when listening to the news, or reading the newspaper, or listening to local gossip, are statements and snippets of information that support their view that the world is a terrible place. So in order to become conscious of different objects in one's daily experience, one needs to be introduced to new concepts. If you are going to get a different understanding and appreciation of your inner universe, you have to get rid of old concepts that bring suffering in their wake and replace them with new concepts that introduce wisdom and peace into your world. But it's impossible to just throw out old, outworn, useless concepts, for the simple reason that one doesn't know which ones are useful and which are useless and destructive to one's well-being. So what is done is one introduces a new concept. For example, one introduces into one's philosophy of life the view that all conditioned things change. And then one sets about trying as frequently as possible to notice whether things do or don't change. After giving it a sufficiently long try, one notices that things do indeed change. And furthermore, they change very rapidly and from moment to moment. Then one day it dawns on one that a year or two ago, one really hadn't been aware as to just how much change does go on inside oneself, in one's body and mind. One realizes then that there must have been a fairly fixed view that things inside oneself were stable, but one had just not been aware of that view. One doesn't so much consciously throw out the old view that things are permanent, as it drops away, the more one notices how much and how rapidly mind and body changes. But you need to be introduced to the concept of change and to turn your attention in that direction Otherwise, you just don't become aware of the mark of change. At this point, you may raise an objection and say, how on earth am I going to become aware of thoughts, feelings, mental states and bodily movement if I can't even concentrate on the rise and fall for more than three counts? Surely I have to be concentrated in order to be aware of changes in mind and body. Won't I just get lost in thinking if I can't produce the clarity of seeing and detachment that comes from concentration? Well, there are levels upon levels of concentration, and the level needed in order to notice change in sufficient quantities to make inroads into breaking up depression, or any negative state for that matter, is brought about simply by having the mark of change pointed out to you, and then you trying to concentrate on the rise and fall. The noticing of change is also aided if during your daily routine you try to keep your attention in the present moment with whatever you are doing. Whether you're walking down a road, driving a car, making a meal, or whatever, if you try and keep the attention on what you are doing. This trying to concentrate, either on the rise and fall, or on what you are doing during the day, points out change like you've never noticed it before. Because you're trying to keep the mind pinned onto one object, and you're not succeeding. Not succeeding in keeping the attention on rise and fall raises the awareness of the things that drag the mind away. You notice that you are paying attention to a sound instead of the rise and fall, or a pain in the back instead of the rise and fall, or a thought instead of the rise and fall. Or you notice you're bored and don't want to pay attention to the rise and fall. Through all of this time, you are noticing other things as well as the rise and fall. You only notice them because they are not where you want to be, which is on the rise and fall. So you start off meditating, knowing that what you have to do is get the mind onto rise and fall and keep it there, and also notice change. You meditate day in, day out, and gradually it dawns on you that your health goes up and down. This is noticing the mark of change in your body. You also notice your mental states change from day to day. Then you start noticing that they change from hour to hour. 1 hour happy, the next hour sad. Then you do a residential course, and you are amazed at how 1 hour of seated practice is restless and full of pain, and the next hour is peaceful and calm. And then the following seated hour is different yet again. Thus, one's experience of a nature of change has deepened because one's become more aware of how rapidly things do change. Now you start to really calm down. With this calmness comes a greater capacity to settle on the rise and fall more frequently. Once you concentrate on rise and fall more often, you begin to notice that one moment there is awareness of sound, next a thought, next a back pain, next rise and fall, and the realization grows that those are all different objects, and that when you are no longer aware of a sound, but aware of a thought, change has occurred. The object of sound has changed into the object of thought. So now you are noticing how quickly things change within 5 minutes, whereas previously you had only been aware of how rapidly things changed from hour to hour. This being aware of things changing from moment to moment, rather than from week to week or hour to hour, is a further increase in one's experiential understanding of anicca. As the realization gets deeper and deeper that things do change, the following happens. When depression arises, up comes the habitual thought, "This will last forever." But following close on its heels is a counteracting thought, "No, it can't. Things don't last forever." So one doesn't hang on quite so fiercely to the depression as one previously did. Thus, the depression doesn't last as long as it used to. This weakening of clinging brings on a more peaceful state of mind compared to what used to exist when depression was round as a solid mass for months and months. However, it may not be what you would normally call peaceful. One normally associates peacefulness with pleasurable feelings and with the complete absence of any depression. But any increase in the understanding of how one operates and any lessening of inner turmoil is peacefulness, is it not? Growth and understanding of how your internal world operates brings a certain settling of the mind, and that is peacefulness. Knowledge of what you do to bring about a lessening of depression is uplifting, and that too brings a sense of peace. Many a shop assistant, businessman, married woman, teenager, all are aware that they get depressed and resentful and angry, but they don't know what to do to stop it. And that not knowing is an added agony. When you know what to do to stop the negative states, that brings peace. Actually putting a stop to those states, even if only for a moment, brings a deepening of that peace. Meditation training consists of working in many areas besides just turning the attention back to rise and fall time and time again. And all the different areas one works in brings about a gradual adjustment to one's wrong views about those things that pull the mind off the rise and fall. Yet another area which is good to work on is the first and second noble truths. The first noble truth is that there is suffering in the world. The second noble truth is that this suffering is caused by craving. When one first hears the term craving, one immediately thinks that craving is wanting £1,000,000, wanting a Caribbean cruise, wanting expensive clothes, wanting a first-class meal in an expensive restaurant. Or, one sees craving as wanting to be royalty and admired by millions, or wanting to be a famous pop star. And as one only occasionally wants these sort of things, maybe one gets a bit grumpy from time to time, because one has to have omelets and chips yet again, when one would dearly love an expensive meal in an exclusive restaurant. And having decided that these things are craving, one comes to the conclusion that one hardly ever craves for anything. But one knows one feels down at least once a month, sometimes once a week, sometimes even more frequently than that. And quite early on in one's contact with Buddhism and meditation, one comes across the premise that suffering arises due to craving, and feeling down is suffering. So you begin to wonder, You wonder if perhaps your original definition of craving needs a little expanding. With time, you refine your ideas on craving and discover that comparison is craving. When you come to realize that just a simple little comparison, like comparing the pain in your back with wanting no pain, you then understand why it is you and those around you sink downhill several times a month. If every time you're feeling down, you retrospect, you look back and try and discover the comparison. What is it you want that you don't have now? Perhaps it is you want your relationship to improve, or you want more sleep, or you want more calm. Discovering what it is that you've compared the present moment with has the effect of driving home to you that you are only down and feeling so awful because you have compared. You also discover that that must mean you are not accepting the present state of affairs. If once you've located the comparison, you then point out to yourself that every time you compare, that is craving, and that the inevitable result of craving is suffering. If you further remind yourself that you can banish all dejection, all worry, all restlessness, provided you do not compare, that the whole solution lies in your own hands. Nobody can help you. Only you can choose to compare or not compare. You are completely your own architect. It is you who choose to suffer or not. Each time you discover that you compared, the mind becomes more peaceful, even though you've discovered it after the event. You compared, you suffered, and then you looked back to see where you'd compared. Finding the comparison, which you know is the root of your troubles, makes the mind settle, makes it more peaceful. Looking backwards for the cause of your suffering every time you feel off means you are training yourself as to just what it is you should be aware of in mind. And with continual practice, you will come to notice the comparison at the time that it happens, which stops the whole process dead in its tracks, and the resultant suffering doesn't arise. This is what you are ultimately aiming at, noticing comparison at the moment you do it. But the looking backwards, the searching for the comparison that has brought about the present state of gloom, is most helpful. The reason why suffering doesn't arise if you are aware of a comparison, but don't take that comparison seriously, is because you haven't acted. Believing in the content of a comparison is action. It is karma. Every time you make an action, it is inevitably followed by a resultant. The resultant of comparison is suffering. The complete dropping of comparison becomes easier when one fully understands that what one has in the moment is real, but what one is comparing with is illusion. A little illustration. This may help to clarify what is meant by illusion. When one is watching a film on television, if the story is sad, one cries. If the story is happy, one is uplifted. But all the time, even when deeply engrossed in that film, one knows that it is only a film. It is a fantasy. It is an illusion. One doesn't take it seriously no matter how many changes of mood the film takes one through. It doesn't cause one to seriously consider changing one's whole way of life. How many people have you heard say, "I decided to leave university because of a film I watched," or "I decided to become a recluse because of a film I watched"? Very few. I've never heard anyone say that. Documentary TV reports, however, they are different. They can stir people to change their approach to life, but not fictional films. After a film is over, one keeps reminding oneself that the film was a fantasy. Maybe for hours afterwards, odd scenes from the film will pop into mind. And if one had found it a sad scene, once again, feelings of sadness will be aroused. Still, one is conscious that such experiences are only memories of a fictional film. So one sort of dismisses the memories and any thoughts that arise dependent upon those memories as not being worthy of bothering about. Now, why can't we have exactly the same attitude to our comparisons? For what we compare the present moment with is something that existed in the past, or what we imagine will exist in the future. Both the past and the future are a fantasy, because they don't exist right now. A fantasy is unreal, just like a fictional movie is unreal. So why can't we regard comparisons like we do a film? Why can't we regard them as an illusion and not take them seriously? Let's say you are on a residential course and doing a seated meditation. What is actually happening in the moment is you are sitting on a chair in a room, in a house in Bradford-on-Avon. That is real. Any thoughts about what you are going to do over the weekend, or what you are going to do in the future? Will I have enough money to live on? Will I be made redundant? Will the firm keep me on? All such imaginings are not what is actually occurring in the moment. You are not dealing with finances right now. You are not standing in front of the boss being told that you have been made redundant. In fact, you're not even at work. You're sitting on a chair in a room. That's what's really happening in the moment. That is what is real. All else is speculation, dream, fantasy. You've made it up. You've created it, and now you're frightening yourself with its contents. When you notice that the thing you are comparing the present moment with doesn't exist, then it becomes easier to not take it seriously and to drop the comparison. When you also notice that comparison brings on suffering, that is an added spur to helping you give up comparison. This constant focusing on comparison and on anicca gradually brings about a settling of the mind. One notices one's starting to accept the pains, the restlessness, the sleepiness more and more. That acceptance makes one feel peaceful. When all of this has been worked through and the overall tone of the mind day in and day out has become more peaceful, one is about ready to go back and do properly the instruction one first received when starting meditation, which was: concentrate the attention on the rise and fall of the abdomen, which comes about dependent upon breathing. It was such a simple instruction. It's so difficult to accomplish. When much time has passed and many of our wrong attitudes have been abandoned, once a stage is reached, then the mind is sufficiently peaceful to settle consistently on rise and fall. When the tone of the mind is more peaceful, then the next thing that occurs is the deep peacefulness that comes from pure concentration. You've turned the mind to rise and fall. It watches the rise in a light and easy manner. It watches the fall in a light and easy manner. It says the number one in a light and easy manner. It continues like this up to 10, then 20, then 30. Occasionally, it watches a sound come and go, or a feeling come and go, or a perception come and go, or a thought come and go. All the time, the mind is light, bright, workable, staying easily with the rise and fall for about 80% of the hour. It's not running off and getting lost in thought, nor is it getting lost in comparison. This is the peacefulness of the concentrated mind. It is quite delicious. And how did it get to this concentrated state? Only through first developing the peacefulness that comes from being aware of the mark of change, and the peacefulness that comes from being aware of comparison and how comparison brings suffering.